It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here. And he, I know, you know, it's funny when something like the Equifax breach happens. I don't know about you, but I just wait all week just to hear what Steve has to say about it. Well, your wait is over. Equifax and a lot more coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 628, recorded Tuesday, September 12th, 2017. Equifax fiasco. Security Now is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/securitynow. And by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software used by over 10 million people. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/securitynow. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover security. Now, with this guy right here, Stephen Gibson of the GRC, Gibson Research Corporation at grc.com. Steve is a security researcher, discoverer of spyware. He also wrote the first anti-spyware tool, and he's been doing this show now for 13 years. We've been doing this show for 13 years since we were young men. All about security and privacy. Hi, Steve.
Yes, Leo. It was about 12 and a half years ago. We were in Toronto between filming breaks, and you said, what would you think about doing a weekly, maybe like a half an hour podcast on the week's security events? And I said, a what cast? No one had ever heard of that.
You hadn't even heard of podcasts at the time. Yeah. Wow.
Yep.
I see you're growing the mustache back.
Well, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm lost.
Well, I never saw Jerry Purnell without a mustache. And I was even looking at old video of him from the 70s, and he had that pencil mustache that he was famous for. So,
and his bolo, remember, the look, I don't know what you call it, sort of, he had like
a bolo tie,
exactly. Anyway, so today's podcast 628 is of course titled The Equifax Fiasco, and so we'll pull all of this together. A couple of our foreign listeners said, what's a credit bureau? So you know, I guess they do things differently elsewhere. So, but I've, you know, this is of course the big secure news of the week. So we're going to cover that. And, we want to talk briefly about Jerry Purnell, our very good friend and colleague who passed away Friday, peacefully in his sleep at the age of 84, about a month after celebrating his 84th birthday. Also about when AI is turned to evil purpose, which unfortunately apparently is going to be a thing before long. Whether and when Chrome's the Google Chrome browser will warn of man-in-the-middle attacks. There was a lot of interest among our listeners about this news that Chrome's going to do it. It turns out that's a little bit of a red herring, and it kind of has to be because this is being done so much now. Also, why it appears that Google is attempting to patent pieces of a compression technology that they did not invent, which I imagine maybe you and Jeff and Stacey will expand on tomorrow. But there's sort of some interesting technical angles to it. Another horrifying consumer router vulnerability disclosure, this time including 10 zero-day vulnerabilities. An update on this forthcoming sunsetting of Symantec's Certificate Authority business unit, another worrying failure of operations over at Komodo. We just keep coming back to those guys. A couple quick bits, and then we're going to close the loop on one listener question, and then we're going to talk about the Equifax fiasco in detail. So I think a perfect picture of the week that ties in, but we'll get to that in a second.
Nice. I can't wait. Always enjoy those. For those of you listening live, yeah, we know Steve's having a little glitching still, but for those of you on the podcast, apologies again for last week, but I think we'll have a good sounding podcast for you because Steve's recording his end locally. You'll probably sound better than ever before. We'll see.
I don't think it'll help, but okay.
Your mustache will be crystal clear, 4K UHD. All right, I'm going to get you hungry because it's time to talk about our sponsor, Blue Apron. I'm a big fan of Blue Apron. As you know, I cook Blue Apron several times a week. Blue Apron is the largest fresh delivery and fresh ingredient and recipe delivery country in the nation. Rightly so. They're the best. I mean, they're amazing. Fresh, delicious ingredients, exactly the right number and proportions to make an amazing meal, plus the recipe card and everything you need. Even if you've never done anything but boil water, even if you can't boil water, you will love Blue Apron. As low as $8.99 per person per meal. Very healthy, fresh, and delicious. I don't know how they do it. It's kind of magical. The produce that comes in my Blue Apron box each week is better than the stuff I might get at the store. I mean, it is perfect. There's no weekly commitment. You only get deliveries when you want them. And, of course, you can customize the recipes every week based on your dietary preferences. So go to blueapron.com/security now and click the menus button to take a look at, you know, on the menu, what's available this week on the menu. And pick three. Seared steaks and roasted vegetables with balsamic glazed mushrooms. Ancho chili chicken tacos. Yes, they have vegetarian options too. Pepper, onion, and olive pizza with spicy broccoli. Or fresh gnocchi and summer squash with tomatoes and sweet peppers. These are always seasonal, which is really nice. You'll try ingredients you may never have tried before. Spiced frika and chickpea bowls with glazed carrots and labneh. Well, I know now what frika and labneh are, but I never knew before until I cooked with Blue Apron. I love it. They have plans for couples and also for families with kid-friendly ingredients that just make your mouth water. They fill the house with amazing aromas. You'll feel great about cooking this. And if you get your kids involved, they'll learn a skill that will last them their whole life. Go to blueapron.com/security now. Be sure to check out the Blue Apron Market on the website, too, for new pantry items. They have a lot of really useful tools. Oh, there's little Kristen who is making a delicious Blue Apron burger. Isn't that cute? BlueApron.com/security now. Your first three meals are free with your first purchase and free shipping. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to make incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. BlueApron.com/security now. I always look forward to getting home and open up the Blue Apron box to see what we have. All right, Steve, let's see that image you were talking about.
Oh, boy. A picture of the week instills real confidence in Equifax.
Oh, boy.
On their security encryption page, it starred in the United States. You can order all Equifax products online with confidence using Netscape and Internet Explorer.
Netscape?
Oh, yes.
The Netscape?
Netscape Navigator, Leo. What? Under SSL and 128-bit encryption. If you have Netscape Navigator, simply select Help from the menu bar. And down lower, it explains about the broken key that Netscape Navigator shows if you don't have encryption.
Is it possible are still people using Netscape? No.
Now, this company is on the leading edge of security technology.
Holy cow. That's unbelievable.
Talk about being inattentive. So
this is on their current website?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Well, there were lots of mistakes that they made in the various pages they put out. I'm really looking forward to hearing your dissection of this one.
Yeah. So I did just want to take a moment for a little bit of memoriam to our very good friend and colleague, Jerry Pournelle. I knew him pretty well back in the early days of the PC industry. And I mentioned before that his wife, Roberta, is a real hugger. And it always used to seem to really annoy him that whenever the three of us would run into each other at a computer show, Roberta and I would give each other an extra long hug. And he'd sort of stand there looking a little flustered, something like, okay, when is this going to be over?
I love it.
So he was born on August 7th, 1933. So he had his birthday, his 84th birthday last month. And his son wrote last Friday, he said, "I'm afraid that Jerry passed away. We had a great time at Dragon Con. He did not suffer." So, and of course, as we know, because he was around Twit during the time that he was fighting that brain cancer that bounce back from and recover from. I mean, so, you know, the guy was tough. And boy, what a pivotal personality through the whole formation of the, you know, the early PC industry and, you know, Byte Magazine, Chaos Manor, and all of his contributions over the years.
Yeah, he was a great treasured contributor on Twit. 20 different Twits. We also did two triangulations with him, which if you want to know more about his life and times, they were great. He had some great things to say.
Yeah, and he and Larry Niven, another sci-fi author, put themselves together, and they wrote a number of books together. My all-time favorite, though, was The Mote in God's Eye,
yeah,
which is just so sometimes you get – in fact, I think all of their books, come to think of it, and it may have been Larry's influence, but I know that Jerry was the same way. There's like a core concept that is, you know, sitting around coffee or something, they come up with an idea. And so – and like that's really good. And it just – it stands alone. And then they encapsulate this perfect, pure – surprise in a fully fleshed out sci-fi setting. And that's what The Mote in God's Eye is. You're reading along and it's really interesting, but you have and they're leaving clues along, so it's sort of a mystery kind of, but there's like a big oh my goodness, it like jumps out at you about three quarters of the way through. So just, you know, a really pleasant read. And for what it's worth, if anyone has never had the chance to read The Mo-Fi Classic, and definitely worthwhile. So, Jerry, you will be missed. Gizmodo covered an interesting story, although I did the math that they did and came to a different conclusion than they. Although it shouldn't surprise us that the bad guys will be weaponizing AI for their own nefarious purposes. Last year, Gizmodo writes, two scientists from the security firm ZeroFox conducted an experiment to see who was better at getting, better at getting Twitter users to click on malicious links, humans or an AI. The researchers taught an AI to study the behavior of social network users and then design and implement its own phishing bait. In the tests, the artificial hacker was substantially better, and I'll take issue with that in a second, than its human competitors, composing and distributing more phishing tweets than humans and with a substantially better conversion rate. The AI, which was named Snap_R, sent simulated spear phishing tweets to over 800 users at a rate of 6.75 tweets per minute, luring 275 of those 800 into the phishing scheme. By contrast, Forbes staff writer Thomas Fox Brewster, who's, you know, we've often quoted him on the podcast, who participated in the experiment, was only able to pump out 1.075 tweets a minute as opposed to 6.75, making just 129 attempts and luring just 49 users. So as I'm reading this, immediately my rough math says, okay, wait a minute, that's about the same conversion rate. Different gross rate, but the same fraction. Anyway, Gizmodo finishes saying, thankfully, this was just an experiment, but the exercise showed that attackers are already in a position to use AI for their nefarious ends. And in fact, they're probably already using it, though it's hard to prove. In July, a couple months ago, at Black Hat USA 2017, hundreds of leading cybersecurity experts gathered, as we know, in Las Vegas, Gizmodo writes, to discuss this issue and other looming threat posed by emerging technologies. In a Cylance poll held during the confab, attendees were asked if criminal hackers will use AI for offensive purposes in the coming year, to which 62% answered in the affirmative. Okay, so I guess this should not be surprising, but I checked the math, and that, you know, the capture rate or the conversion rate was almost the same for both the human, that is Thomas Fox Brewster, and the AI. It was 34.4% versus 38%. And those are not statistically significant differences for such a small sample size. So, I mean, so that difference with such a small sample set could have just been, you know, chance, luck of the draw. So the takeaway here is that it's certainly worrisome that an AI could be at least as good as a human, because, you know, that's zero effort and it's automatable and it's infinitely scalable. So, you know, not good news for us, but again, also not very surprising, but, you know, worth sort of just putting on our radar, because we do put things on our radar and they come back to bite us almost invariably. In fact, we talked about this whole credit freeze thing 2.5 years ago, Leo, and we'll get to that later. But I thought, okay, yeah, you know, our listeners who took our advice then weren't in any danger from this, or at least right, comparatively so. There's even a Bitly link I created that I verified was still valid, bit.ly/creditfreeze. And it still works.
Is it linked to all three of the other reporting agencies? Or?
It takes us to a page which has been maintained, which walks a consumer through the processes for all three bureaus. Yes. Yeah. And so it was good then, and it's still good today. So again, you know, this is one of the fun things we get to do on a 12-plus-year podcast, is, you know, see how these threats and issues evolve over time. Another sort of a red herring, as I said at the top of the show, was this news that Chrome, Google's browser, of course, would soon be warning us of software that performs man-in-the-middle attacks. Well, first of all, I didn't know how it could do that, because as we have now been discussing a lot, many enterprises are doing so-called middle boxes. That is, they're doing HTTPS proxying on their border in order to be able to inspect the traffic that's moving into their intranet and protect themselves from it in case it's malicious. Because as we know, post Snowden, the world's going encryption. So in digging into this story, which confused me, it turns out that there was a summer intern just this past summer who, for her project, looked at adding this technology to Chrome, which will get incorporated, but it seems like what is actually going on is that there's a gray area in improperly or poorly written middle boxes, which can do some sort of breakage, and wasn't able to get any details. Maybe when it actually rolls out, we'll be able to come back to this and understand what's going on. But I did want to note to our listeners, because I got a bunch of people saying, hey, look, this is going to prevent snooping. It's like, no, it won't. And remember, the other really unanswered question is whether, like, what Chrome does. Because remember that Chrome pins the signatures of all of Google's certificates in itself. So, and this is how so many fraudulently issued Google certs have immediately come to Google's attention, because any person who uses Chrome, who goes to a Google asset, which is coming from a fraudulent certificate, immediately sends a beacon back to Google saying, hey, I just saw a Google cert that you guys didn't produce. So the point is that middle boxes are synthesizing their own certificates on the fly, thus the signatures would not match and Chrome would not be happy. So it may be that those middle boxes whitelist the Google domains and pass them through without trying to intercept them in order to keep Chrome from I just don't know, but that would be one way to do it. But so what is this feature that Chrome is adding is some sort of quality metric where, and again, I'm just unfortunately there isn't anything that I was able to find that had the nitty gritty, which everyone knows that I prefer to work from, but it's if some threshold of errors are occurring, then the user is warned with a big intercept screen, big scary thing that comes up and says something to the effect of your firewall or AV is misinstalled, is what it says, and inducing errors, you need to fix that. So the idea is it will be tolerant of the well-written, properly performing interception, but not poorly done interception. And again, I hate that I don't know exactly what that means, but hopefully at some point we will get some clarification. It says this will appear in Chrome 63, and so on the horizon, and as a result of some work by a summer intern. So, but again, I did want to back our listeners away because many people picked up on this and said, hey, that looks great. It's like, well, okay, apparently it's just to help clean up the industry, which is, again, a good thing. As we know, Google often uses its clout in order to discipline people who are behaving badly. And this story is interesting too. Google has been accused of trying to patent public domain technology. This surrounds an arithmetic data compression approach, which was deliberately placed in the public domain by its developer, a Polish assistant professor who goes by Jarek Duda, D-U-D-A, who has accused Google of trying to patent technology he invented and deliberately placed into the public domain specifically so that no one could own it. I mean, his research was paid for by his university and he just wanted to give this away and keep it from being locked down. We were talking just recently when we were talking about the decompression of the firmware in the Intel management engine and Huffman coding, how it uses variable length tokens to represent variable frequency occurrences. Well, that's a form of arithmetic encoding and an arithmetic compression. This guy has a much, much more advanced form of, as it's called, entropy coding, which is known as an asymmetric numerical system, or ANS, which he's been working on from 2006 through 2013. And a number of companies have jumped on this and adopted it. There's a variation called TANS and another one called RANS. It's used in Apple's LZFSE compressor. Facebook uses this in their Z standard compressor, and Google is employing it in their Draco 3D compressor. So, patents are weird. And from this distance, it's impossible to judge. I don't know what Google is thinking or if this professor is, you know, feeling very proprietary about his technology. And in fact, Google maybe, you know, may have had some innovations they've added. There is a third party involved, which is there's an international patent group that is siding with the professor, believing that what Google's claims are alleged to be are just already in the public domain, well known, already in practice, and so forth. But again, as I said, patents are tricky. Sometimes you initially go in with a deliberately overbroad application, and then, and as we were talking just last week, sometimes you just get lucky. Well, unfortunate for us, and the patent office says, yeah, okay, fine. And then, of course, you have to litigate that in court, which would not be easy to do when Google is on the other side of that. Or more often, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office will come back and say, well, claims 13, 14, and 15 we will allow, but 1 through 12, no, we're going to disallow those. And so there's some, you know, it's why it takes many years typically, and there's some back and forth. So it could be that Google has innovated on top of the existing technology, which many patents, many do grant. We'll have to see how this thing plays out. Apparently, Google is being silent. There's some belief in the industry that they've pulled this back and they're going to rework it in order to make it more clear, you know, what they've done and what they have. So we'll see how this evolves over time. It's not absolutely clear where things stand. Although, as I said, some independent judges have looked at this and don't feel that there's anything that really merits the label of invention and intellectual property protection. Add to our list of routers behaving badly, a recent state-of-the-art D-Link router, the 850L, which is a wireless AC 1200 dual band gigabit cloud router. I put cloud in quotes because it has built-in cloud features. It's got something called My D-Link Cloud Services, which allow you to access, view, and control the devices on your home network from anywhere. So, you know, that's a powerful capability, and you would like the router to be secure. Unfortunately, a researcher initially examined this router for his participation in a contest and was quickly appalled by what he found. Then he found 10 different worrisome zero-day vulnerabilities of varying concern, which I'll run through here in a second, tried to responsibly disclose to D-Link, who never worked with him, kept silent, he waited for months with no effective, with no apparent action. And then there was some disclosure where they didn't acknowledge this came from him, but said, well, a researcher happened to discover a couple problems. And so it's still not clear. And in the most recent updates, they still haven't fixed everything. So anyway, the 1,000-foot view of this is, if you have a D-Link 850L, I've read several accounts saying just unplug it because you see why here. So there's two different firmware releases, a version A and a version B. A is not protected in any way. So firmware images can be forged by attackers. There's no protection. B added password protection. Unfortunately, the password is hard-coded and never changed, so that doesn't really afford any protection. Okay, so in the Rev-A firmware, both on the WAN and the LAN side, and this researcher in enumerating these problems was careful to differentiate the two, because, of course, as we know, landside vulnerabilities are not good. If something gets into your network, or depending on like how large your network is, if you were an enterprise using one of these 850L D-Link routers on your perimeter, then any employee in a sufficiently large corporation would have access to the router from the LAN side. Of course, we know the WAN side is a much bigger concern because that's the world that has access. And as we've seen, as we've been talking lately or recently, there are search engines like Shodan that can find all these things. So the Rev-A firmware exposes both on the public WAN and the private LAN cross-site scripting vulnerabilities with PHP files, which can be exploited as a consequence of these cross-site scripting vulnerabilities to steal authentication cookies from the router. That's in the Rev-A firmware. On the Rev-B firmware, both WAN and LAN, it's possible to retrieve the admin password for the router to gain then full access using this custom MyD-Link cloud. And apparently without breaking the D-Link's terms of use, this researcher found vulnerabilities which could allow attackers to abuse this cloud protocol and register the router to their own accounts to then gain full and unfettered access to the user's D-Link cloud and all the internals of their network. So, you know, just abominable security. It turns out also that this cloud protocol is fundamentally weak. So independent of firmware version, there's a WAN side exposure. The researcher wrote that the MyD-Link cloud protocol is little more than a basic TCP relay system with no encryption by default. Traffic is sent over TCP to the Amazon servers that host cloud without encryption. So it's fully susceptible to sniffing and to man in the middle. Because remember, if you don't have encryption, that is if you don't have HTTPS and TLS encryption, you have no authentication of the endpoint, meaning that anybody could intercept your connection and have at what's going on back and forth. Also, the router interface allows users to enter credentials for their email accounts, which are then sent from the router to the server without encryption or verification. And the passwords are stored in clear text. So, the more you look at this, the more it looks like a whole bunch of features that look fine on the surface, but absolutely no attention to underlying security and protocol. Just none. There's a backdoor on the LAN. There is a secure tunnel, which both on the WAN and the LAN side, but they use hard-coded private keys, which anyone can determine. They never change. And so even though you use S-Tunnel to in some cases, to talk to this thing, the keys are known and fixed, so no actual protection. And nothing like, you know, Diffie-Hellman dynamic key exchange. It's just no one's caring here. There's also, it just goes on and on. There's a way to brute force the DNS configuration to allow the DNS config to be changed without admin user authentication checks, which allows anyone to reroute your DNS to a malicious DNS server. And we know that's like the first thing you want to do if you want to spoof a website's identity is return fraudulent IP addresses for legitimate DNS queries. There's weak file permissions, and credentials are stored in the router in clear text, which a remote attacker has access to. There are remote code execution vulnerabilities where you have the ability to run as root the DHCP server, which we know a router will get its IP address and gateway and other setup details over the dynamic host configuration protocol. Turns out that daemon in the router has all kinds of vulnerabilities that allow that query to be manipulated to allow a remote code execution with root privileges. And there's also the ability to DDoS or DOS some of the daemons that are running the router. So D-Link, if you do have an 850L, be very wary. This is one of those situations where just replace it with something like the $49 Edge Router X or with a PF Sense router or something. It's just, you know, we're seeing these things being sold, which, you know, from companies that evidence no interest in the underlying security of their offerings and of the concern for their customers. And you know, end users don't know. It's up to security researchers and vehicles like this podcast to help spread the word and just to create, I think, a level of awareness that unfortunately has to be present. It'll be interesting to see how this evolves, how we create more responsibility, except maybe for consumers over time to just wander away from companies whose reputations have not afforded them the kind of demonstration of a concern over security that they should have. And I'm thirsty, Lee. Let's take a break.
Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. If you are an entrepreneur, if you're a small business person, and by which I don't mean short in height, but merely small in your business, if you're a sole proprietor, you need to know about FreshBooks. And I don't diminish small business persons. I am a small business person, and I was a really small business person about 10 years ago when I first used FreshBooks. I was doing the Call for Help show in Canada, and I had to every month bill Rogers in Canadian dollars. That was problem number one, and send them all my expenses, and that was problem number two, and the receipts. And Amber told me about FreshBooks, and my life changed. Your life will change if you go right now to freshbooks.com/securitynow and give it a try 30 days free. It's come a long way since I first used it. Still the same great people up in Toronto, same great support staff, really friendly, nice people. But FreshBooks now does so much more. It's really everything you need to know about your business. Because, of course, when you do the invoicing, now you've got the accounts receivable. When you do the expenses, now you've got the expenses. In effect, you're doing accounting without doing accounting, without even thinking about it. And FreshBooks uses that information to put on right on the front page of the new FreshBooks dashboard your profit or loss. You'll know exactly where you stand at any given time. And sending out those professional-looking FreshBooks invoices means you're going to get paid on average 11 days faster. That's what I discovered. Well, I discovered that if you don't invoice, you don't get paid at all. So it was a huge improvement when I just became more regular in my invoicing. You can brand the invoices with your logo. They look great. You can set up recurring invoices. You can set up recurring payments even if your client's up for that, which is great. Automatic payment reminders, automatic late fees. You don't have to do all of that collection thing anymore. It just kind of happens automatically. You can even reward prompt clients and encouraging customer loyalty by adding discounts to recurring templates. Is that sweet? You paid me fast. I'm going to give you 10% off. I love that. It's easy to do time and hours because the FreshBooks apps, iOS and Android, have a, you know, start the clock, stop the clock. You can break it down by project, break it down by client. You can assign services to projects and designate the different rates for each service. So it's really granular. And then the beauty is all of that information gets
boom, right up into the invoice. And because it's in the invoice, into your overall accounting. All you have to do is just press the play button. You're tracking your time to the minute. And now entries are sorted chronologically on the invoice for you to automatically. So it couldn't be easier. In fact, that's one of the things I like about FreshBooks. It's web hosted. So it's always, they're always adding features. Every week they add a feature or two. So it seems like it's just always getting better and better. Well, it is. Now you can see receipt attachments when you view invoices in the iOS app. Employees can log in on the FreshBooks mobile app for iOS, making it easy for them to take care of business wherever they are if you have employees. Of course, they've got FAQ articles with a new help widget. You just click on the blue question mark anywhere in FreshBooks, and you'll find more information about it. You don't have to be an accounting whiz to get the information you need for yourself day-to-day, for your accountant when tax time comes. No wonder FreshBooks was included in the Forbes Small Giants list for 2017. They are a great company with a great product. And now, for the first 30 days free, all you have to do is go to FreshBooks.com/security now. Do me and Steve a favor when it says, how did you hear about us? Say security now in the how did you hear about us section, and we'll get credit for that. And we thank you so much for doing that, and we thank FreshBooks for their support of this show, Security Now.
So, okay, we've talked about the problem that Symantec had with misissuing certificates. And in one case, one of their partners that they had delegated responsibility to not being responsible with the issuing of certificates. And the industry has decided that they're going to sunset trust. So what happened yesterday was that Google's security blog updated the industry on where they stand. And it also included some important information for site owners, which I want to cover, and then also bring up something that I don't think we talked about before, which is the potential impact on IoT devices that this could have. So Google wrote in their blog, after they said, this provides a bit of Google side perspective about the Symantec DigiCert agreement and what it means also practically for website operators, is that after our agreed upon proposal was circulated, Symantec announced the selection of DigiCert to run its independently operated managed partner infrastructure, as well as their intention to sell their PKI, their public key infrastructure business, to DigiCert in lieu of building a new trusted infrastructure. And this is what we talked about before, is that Symantec just said, okay, we're going to transfer our business unit essentially and the public key infrastructure to an already trusted certificate authority, in this case DigiCert, because that just makes the most sense. So Google explained for website operators what this means. We were just talking about how this poor man in the middle implementation detection will work in Chrome 63. Starting with Chrome 66, which is around March 15th of 2018 in beta, and the stable track users will get it about a month later on April 17th, 2018. So starting with that version, Chrome 66, Chrome will remove trust in Symantec issued certificates issued prior to June 1st, 2016. So prior to, this summer, June 1st of this summer. So that happens like after the first quarter of next year. So Google writes, if you're a site operator with a certificate issued by a Symantec certificate authority prior to June 1st, 2016, then prior to the release of Chrome 66, you will need to replace the existing certificate with a new certificate from any certificate authority trusted by Chrome. So, and that's, I mean, hopefully all sites who are using such certificates are aware of this and getting this news, because it'll come as a rude awakening after the first quarter next year when Chrome users are no longer able to connect to them. They'll be getting errors from Chrome. Okay, and then in addition, by December 1st of this year, so a few months from now, December 1st, 2017, Symantec will transition issuance and operation of publicly trusted certificates to DigiCert's infrastructure, and certificates issued from the old Symantec infrastructure after this date will not be trusted by Chrome. So that says that there is a period between June 1st and December 1st, so that through this summer into fall, where certificates issued then are trusted, but Symantec's operations will be shut down and fully transferred to DigiCert by December 1st, so no certificates should be issued by Symantec, and in any event, Chrome won't trust them. Because again, remember, there's a concern that we're not really sure the extent of what happened with Symantec. You know, reports have varied, but it's better in this case just to say, okay, we're no longer going to trust those. So, and then finally, around the week of October 23rd, 2018, so more than a year from now, about 13 months from now, Chrome 70 will be released, which will fully remove trust in Symantec's entire previous infrastructure and all of the certificates that have been issued. So essentially, what Chrome will be doing for until that time, until October 23rd, will be looking at the not valid before date, that is the date of issuance, and making a judgment about when that certificate was apparently signed, whether or not to trust it. And then 13 months from now, October 23rd, 2018, the Symantec root will be pulled out, will be removed from Chrome, so that no certificates anywhere ever that were signed using that root will be considered valid. So, you know, we're seeing sort of this drama unfold in real time. We've talked about these things before, and this is not certainly easy for the industry. It creates some upheaval, but it's what we have to do, because as we've said, the whole system only functions, and it functions precariously as it is, because we're trusting implicitly the signatures by so many different certificate authorities, where any certificate can be signed by any certificate authority, and if that signature is trusted, then the certificate is trusted. So, but there is a concern here that could have some impact on consumers, depending upon the design of IoT style systems. Because remember, we're all used to thinking in terms of our client-side OSs, which have a massive store, you know, hundreds of trusted certificate authority root certificates, which, as I said, will be used to trust anything that they sign. But IoT devices, which are inherently lean, may presume the certificate authority of the remote server that they trust. That is, our web browsers, for example, have to trust everybody because we're roaming around the internet. We want our browsers and our systems to be able to go connect to any server anywhere and get authenticate the identity and get a secure connection. But an IoT device inherently has a different architecture. Many of them, for example, webcam, are inherently tied to a specific remote server at a specific domain. And because they're trying to keep their costs down, they're trying to keep their support overhead down and you know, not waste RAM and flash memory and so forth, they may well have a single certificate because they know which certificate authority will always be signing the trusted certificate of the remote site. If authority was Symantec, and the other thing, the other problem is these root certs are very long lived. They've got, you know, expirations decades from now. So there may well be IoT devices where, I mean, remember that Symantec was a major CA for historically. I mean, they're the ones I used. They were like the one back in the day. And I, of course, happily moved way over to DigiCerts quite some time ago. But it may well be that there are hardware devices that only trust Symantec certificates, and there will be no more Symantec certificates for them to trust before long. So, and the idea would be that because an IoT device's root cert has a multi-decade life, the server side could keep refreshing its certificates every 2 or 3 years as required, as we know, yet still be trusted by this single long-lived certificate burned into the firmware of some device. So there's really nothing we as consumers can do. The upshot is that some devices, if they have a single trusted root and that root is Symantec, and hopefully they are establishing secure connections rather than just, you know, unencrypted and unauthenticated connections, they're going to die next year, which will create an additional unexpected problem. We, on our, you know, much more dynamic, full spread client-side OSs, this won't affect us at all, but it does affect the server operators who have to make sure that the certs they're using remain trusted. But again, I'm sure that news will spread sufficiently. And speaking of this problem of any trusted signer being able to sign a certificate for any domain. Note that pinning certificates creates an exception, which we were talking about with Google's Chrome. There is an upcoming standard, but actually it already went into effect last Friday on September 8th, 2017. The requirement for certificate authorities to check the new, relatively new, actually it's been around for a while, but it we've talked about it before, the so-called CAA, the Certificate Authority Authorization Record of domains that is being published by a domain's DNS, went into effect. So the CAB forum, the CA browser forum, established these guidelines. All certificate authorities they have been able to deploy this technology earlier, but it was mandatory last Friday. And what that meant is that before a CA, a certificate authority, would grant a certificate to an applicant, the certificate authority would query that domain's DNS for a CAA record, which was a newly defined DNS record type, which specifies the certificate authorities that domain uses to sign its certificates. So for example, if GRC would have a CAA record that says, my certificates come from DigiCert. So the idea would be that other CAs should, before ever issuing anyone a certificate, a server certificate for GRC, query GRC's DNS and see whether there is a CAA record. If there isn't one, then that means there is no block. That is, okay, this person hasn't said who they buy their certificates from. If there is one, that is, if there is a CAA record which says these are where we get our certificates at this domain, and it does not include that CA, that certificate authority that is issuing, is being asked to issue a certificate, then they must not. So, okay, this is obviously when, you know, as we've seen, this is not strong protection, but we haven't got a way yet to create strong protection. This is better protection. It's very lightweight. It allows anyone who wants to increase their own domain's security to add one of these records so that any other certificate authority who is responsible and does follow the CAB guidelines, the CA Browser Forum guidelines, will refuse to issue a certificate when they should not issue it because they've not been given permission to explicitly by the presence of one of these CAA records. So, unfortunately, the day after this became mandatory, a curious German researcher went over to Komodo, and he has a long-published CAA record for his domain stating that Let's Encrypt is the source of his certificates, and everyone knows where this is headed. Komodo happily issued him a certificate in contravention of the CA browser guidelines, which had gone into mandatory effect the day before. This guy got his certificate, verified it. Since then, many other people have confirmed the same thing, so it's not just a single source of reporting. What's odd is that Komodo has a very nice-looking page on their site where they go on a great length in their knowledge base about the CAA record and how it works and what it does, and they've got links to various types of DNS servers and what you need to do. But unfortunately, they're not this is not just a single report. This is multiple reports now that have verified that this is happening, and they're just deciding, oh, well, this will be a nice technology. Hopefully, they will figure out why they issued that certificate by mistake and start honoring that. Because, again, this doesn't prevent a certificate authority from maliciously or deliberately ignoring that. But, of course, this is, as this researcher just demonstrated, this is also easily tested because, as it is now, any CA, or as it had been, any CA would happily take your money in return for giving you a certificate. Now, that shouldn't happen if there's a CAA record. And again, this is easily tested. So I think what we'll see is quickly that things come into compliance because, you know, we've got, serious companies like Google who have demonstrated that they're willing to subject companies to whatever degree of pain is necessary in order to keep this system up and functioning and trusted, which is what we need. I've got two quick little bits, some follow-ups on some previous coverage of ours. We talked, about a year ago, whenever it was, that that Volkswagen got caught basically with special case software, which was able to detect when its emissions did because the back wheels were spinning, but the front wheels were not. And that sort of disappeared. It just resurfaced again. It turns out that, unfortunately, one of the engineers who was involved in this, he's in charge of the group that produced the software that did this. He's been given 40 months of jail time.
Whoa.
You know, in prison. Yeah.
I think the executives should get the jail time.
That's my feeling, too. That was my immediate reaction was, wait a minute. You know, this guy was probably following orders. So also he's paying a $200,000 fine. The register.co.uk picked up on this. They said as head of the VW diesel competence unit in the U.S., and the engineer's name is James Lang. He oversaw the software function that enabled the cars to cheat the emissions tests. He is also the most junior of the 8 current and former VW executives that have been charged so far. So, yes, there is responsibility being taken. They called it the defeat device, which was designed to recognize when the car was being tested and to switch to a lower emissions setting. When the car was running normally, that setting was removed and emissions were measured at up to, get this, 40 times higher than the permitted levels.
Yeah, but the response was great. It's a cock-a-doodle.
And this, of course, would put on 11 million cars. Oh. The Register writes that the engineers knew full well what they were doing, attempted to hide their tracks, even calling the device by a variety of pseudonyms, including acoustic function, cycle beating software, and emissions tight mode. So it turns out that in terms of like sentencing guidelines, basically the judge threw the book at these people. Good. The federal prosecutor, said that Lang's prison sentence would send, quote, a powerful deterrent message to the rest of the industry. And apparently not just the auto industry will hear that message. Software engineers across the country, write the Register, will have to reflect on the fact that they may be held personally responsible for creating something that knowingly breaks the law. So,
good.
Yes.
Although,
exactly.
I really want to see the executives go to jail. I don't.
I agree. I agree completely.
Sure, he was just following. I was just following orders.
Well, and, you know, I guess he's going to say no and then get.
Well, from now on, I think that's the hope, is that people will think twice and say no when they're asked to do something.
Yeah, I'm not going to prison for pencil necks. Yeah. One other little bit of news about iOS 11 that crossed my radar actually last week, but we didn't have time to talk about it. And that was that we talked previously about the problem of MAC address leakage from our iPhones, and that Apple had taken some, was aware of the problem. That is, in the Ethernet protocol, we know that MAC addresses are used to carry packets, and MAC addresses are globally unique identifiers by design, because the way Ethernet works, that's something that you need to count on not having an address collision with. There was some provision for Apple to obscure the MAC address. That is, if you were probing versus connected, as I recall from our previous discussion of this. Anyway, what Apple decided to do with iOS 11, and bravo to them, although there are some packet capture people that are annoyed, and that is they are removing access to that information completely, so that you will apparently apps have previously had access to the ARP table. That's the address resolution protocol table, where essentially that's a rich source of information. You're able to see all the MAC addresses and IP addresses of all the machines that you're currently seeing around you in your environment, including your own. So by essentially, they're going to just remove that from the application space so that applications will no longer be able to query that to further increase the privacy. So that's, you know, for most applications have no need for it. There are some developers who are chafing at this news because, you know, their particular packet sniffing, packet capture widget was, you know, had access to it. So they're not happy that they're losing it, but, you know, tough. I think from a privacy standpoint, it is, you know, underlying plumbing information which definitely can be used to breach privacy, and that's a problem. I had this in my notes last week, but we didn't have any time, and the news was pretty much focused on Equifax this week, so we have a little more time. I wanted to take a minute to do something I only do every couple years, because this sort of what I see is that as I'm talking in passing and sharing testimonials about SpinRite, I start beginning to get email from newer listeners who are saying, well, you talk about SpinRite every week, but you never explain really what it is, just like it does data recovery stuff. And so over the course of the 12 plus years we've done the podcast, every couple of years I've said, okay, let me just quickly explain what this is. I also want to talk about briefly, catch everybody up on the 6.x plan, my plan for 7, and also the pre-release for 6, the 6.x stuff. So for people who don't know, for listeners who are new to the podcast, SpinRite is it was born more than 30 years ago in a like arguably a very different era of the PC industry. Hard disk drives were very small, like 10, 20, 25 megabytes, not gigabytes and not terabytes, and they used much less technology, so there was much more placed on the user and on the drives themselves had no brains in them at all. All the brains were in the controller. And SpinRite started off with the goal of improving the performance of the drive, because drives at that time were unable to read the data as fast as it was coming off of the disk. The disk was spinning too fast. The data was already too dense that there wasn't a chance to get it into the computer, into its memory. So instead there was this interleaving of sectors was a technology that had already been applied in the non-PC industry, where instead of successive sectors being adjacent, successive logical sectors were put downstream. They were interleaved, so that like every sixth sector would be the next one. That allowed one sector to be read and then some time to pass while that got into RAM, so that you could then ask for the next sector to be read. The problem was there was no provision for optimizing that interleave. That is, for example, IBM set theirs to 6. That is a 6-to-1 interleave. But that meant that it took 6 revolutions of the drive in order to read all the data from one track, and then you could go to the next one. What I discovered 30 years ago was that was not optimal, that many systems could do it in 3, that is a 3-to-1 interleave, and some cases a 2-to-1 interleave. What that meant was that you could reduce it from requiring 6 revolutions in order to suck in the data to just 2. So it made your drive 3 times faster, and that was a big benefit. The problem was, in order to do that, it required that the drive be low-level reformatted to actually physically change where the sectors were. Well, that was something you could not do once the drive had data, except that back then, nobody had anywhere to put their hard drive data except keep it on drive. So the big innovation that I created back with Spinrite One was the world's first and only non-destructive reinterleave. And I did that by tackling it one track at a time. It turns out you could low-level reformat just one track. And so I would read all the data off it, and then I would change the sector ordering to optimize it for data transfer and then put all data back. But being a perfectionist, I thought, okay, I need to make sure I get all the data off. Because once I low-level reformat that track, there's no more data there to get off. So part of the responsibility I undertook was to absolutely, do everything I could to get any data off, especially if the drive wasn't wanting to give it. So, drives back then, as I said, didn't have a lot of technology. They had much lower levels of error correction. They didn't depend upon error correction nearly to the degree we do now, which has happened as bit density has increased. So I built into the very first version of Spinrite arguably the world's best data recovery as a side effect of the fact that this was going to be my last opportunity ever to retrieve data from the hard drive before reformatting it at the lowest level and then putting the data back. So consequently, Spinrite always had world-class data recovery. So years go by, drives get more dense, much more data on them, and at some point, the controller moves into the drive with what we call the IDE drives. And SCSI drives were also very much the same way. They became smart drives and began to encapsulate more and more technology. Of course, then there was also huge pressure to squeeze as much data onto the drives as possible. And as we've talked about, there were much more technology applied in order to always keep the drive kind of on the verge of working, where now more error correction was being used almost continuously, but much more capable error correction also, in order to deal with the inherent softness. So today's Spinrite no longer reinterleaves drives. I can't remember where I took that out. I think I took it out of when I went to Spinrite 5. I said, okay, we're not doing that anymore. All drives are now one-to-one interleave. They're the channels from the drive to the processor and to main memory are all fast enough to handle taking the entire track off in a single revolution. So Spinrite has evolved with the industry over time, no longer optimizing sector interleave, but actually falling back on and becoming useful going forward. And amazingly, even as we've spoken of on SSD drives that don't spin, but do use error correction, which is where Spinrite still comes in, it's evolved into a powerful data recovery system, and just what we talk about when people's files are in danger, run Spinrite on it, drives die, run Spinrite on them, bring them back to life. You have to you have to make a value decision, how much you want to trust it after it died once, because if it's trying to die, and I've said this before, ultimately Spinrite will fail, because if the drive is determined to stop being a hard drive at all, it gets the final say. But Spinrite certainly pulls you back out of a gray zone and keeps your data there typically long enough for you to then back it up or image it or, get another drive and copy it over. So we've been at Spinrite 6.0 since 2004. It's now 13 years, and it's no one need to update it. That's what I will immediately return to as soon as Squirrel is behind me, and that's looking really good. We're struggling with a couple last details, but we're getting very close. So my plan is to ultimately, I want to go to SpinRite 7 and offer a whole bunch of new features, because SpinRite is still just sort of a run-it-in-place system. It made sense back then, but now people are have drives everywhere. So there are a lot of other features I want to add, but I'm going to use the 6-point series, 6.1.2.3, to as sort of a technology development platform to create the technological foundation for 7. So 7 will add will basically be a complete rewrite, but using the foundation that I develop with 6.1, 6.2, and so forth. So what 6.1 will get us is final removal of the BIOS and BIOS dependence, which has been a compatibility benefit in the long term, but recently a problem because BIOSes have not kept up with the drive technology. So that'll go away. SpinRite will talk directly to the hardware, and I had all that running when I suspended the work on 6.1 in order to develop Squirrel. I'll go back to that. That's how I know how fast SpinRite was running, and we've talked about that technology before. But the idea will be the 6.x series will create this new technological foundation that'll be useful immediately for 6 owners, and will create the foundation for 7 moving forward. And I will, as I have committed, make all of the 6 series available at no charge to all existing SpinRite 6 owners. And because I want to give a thanks to the listeners who have been supporting me and making this possible by purchasing SpinRite 6, it will also be available to us on a pre-release basis. That always tends to be the way things work out. Like Squirrel has actually been working, not in finished form, but working for 2 years, or a year and a half at least. And Leo, you'll remember a long time ago, I looked at the screen with Squirrel and logged you in over our Skype connection. Yeah. So I'm sure the same thing will happen. There will be SpinRite will be running, that is, sample, some, you know, well before I am able to say, okay, I've got all the UI or the packaging for the typical end user. So I'm going to make that available early to the podcast's listeners. Nice. as a special thanks to Very nice. To everybody.
Thank you. Well, somebody just joined the show, and he said, have you talked about Equifax yet? That's next. Can't wait to hear Steve's take on Equifeft is what we call it. You've been Equifeft.
I was tempted to call it Equihax, but Equihax. I thought, nah.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, no, it's good. We're going to get into it in a second, but first a word from our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans, the greatest thing ever, as far as I'm concerned, only because of the nightmare I went through, Lisa and I went through when we bought our house 4 years ago. It'd be 4 years next month. But I'll vividly remember it. We were about to go on vacation. We thought, oh, we really want this house. We could probably get a loan in a couple of weeks, right? 1 month later, we're on a cruise ship faxing stuff to the lender. It was one of those big banks. And it was just a nightmare. It took them more than a month to get us the loan. Next time, I promise, it will be Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Quicken Loans, best lender in the country. They've got all the J.D. Power customer satisfaction awards to prove it. They're also the friend of the geek. They've created a loan product just for us geeks that's entirely online. You can find it at rocketmortgage.com/security. Now, you could do it on your phone, your tablet. You could do it. It's so fast. It doesn't take a month or a week or a day or even hours. It takes minutes to get loan approval because you're doing it all online. You don't have to go through paperwork to find your check stubs, your pay stubs, or your checking account, you know, statements. They have trusted partners with all the financial institutions. You just identify yourself, give them permission, and they say, okay, we got what we need. And they start crunching the numbers. And, you know, it's computers. It's online. It's fast. So based on your income, assets, and credits, within minutes, Rocket Mortgage will analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and find the right one just for you. It's kind of magic, really. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. You'll apply simply, you'll understand what's going on fully, and then you can mortgage with confidence. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/security. Now, I know you're probably not buying a house this very moment, so bookmark it, would you? Put it in your browser so you'll be ready. You go, what was that Leo was talking about? It's rocketmortgage.com/security now. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. If you're getting a home loan or if you're doing a refi, do it with the best. rocketmortgage.com/security now. Steve, I'm not going to be here for the next couple of weeks.
I know.
I think Father Robert is going to be taking the helm, depending on whether he's got work for the Pope or not. If not, it'll be Jason Howell.
And you're not kidding when you say
that. I am not kidding. But Robert loves doing this show, and I know you love doing it with him. So I think it'll be Robert, Father Robert Ballester, in the next couple of weeks. And I'll be back in October.
And where are you going?
France.
Oh, nice. French. So I did have one closing the loop item. An Ed Zucker asked, what do I think about Tarsnap as a replacement for CrashPlan? And I've spoken a little bit about Tarsnap in the past. The short version is absolutely yes. It was designed and created by a very good guy, Colin Percival. And it's tarsnap.com. It runs on Unix-like OSs, so not for Windows, although it could run under CYGWin, but so the BSDs, Linux, Mac OS, and so forth. It's security done right. It's full TNO, and it's a service as opposed to a standalone product. So Colin hosts the cloud side, but it's very affordable, and he shows you how to compute your costs, and things are measured in pico dollars.
250 pico dollars per byte month.
Exactly.
Hysterical.
Yeah, he's a neat guy. In fact, he's the one who designed the S-Script memory hard function for Tarsnap, which I took and created N-Script for use with Squirrel. So that gives you a sense for how well how much I respect his crypto stuff. He has a very correctly implemented block deduplication system. You can't do deduplication after you encrypt. So he maintains a hash of blocks on your local client. And then when you're doing an update, new blocks are hashed and shipped against the cache to see whether it's already been stored. If so, it doesn't do it again. If not, then it hashes the block, adds it to the hash cache, then encrypts it locally and sends an – oh, I'm sorry. It then compresses it and then encrypts it, and then sends it up to the server. So if anyone is looking for a replacement to a cloud-based system who has a Unix-like OS, BSD, Linux, Mac OS, and so forth, Tarsnap, I can recommend without hesitation, because Colin definitely knows his technology. Okay. So a listener wrote... He said, I actually tweeted at SGGRC, not an American, so I don't really understand what Equifax does. Mayhaps there'll be an explanation on this week's Security Now.
There must be something. There's no way. I mean, I'm not a fan of the credit reporting agencies, but I can't believe that in Amsterdam you would just walk in and say, I need a car loan, and they go, okay, they're going to check your credit.
There don't
must
know how
be
they
some
do
way
that.
To do it. They just don't call them the same thing. But there's got to be.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
So for our listeners who don't know, what has sort of evolved in the states in the U.S. is a symbiotic relationship between credit grantors and these credit bureaus, as they're called. We have three of them: Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. And so the idea is that someone who's going to grant you credit, a bank or a credit card company, wants to have some warm and fuzzies about your history of paying your debts. You know, are you good for the loan that they're going to give you in one form or another? So these credit agencies, they aggregate three of individual U.S. consumers, and apparently not only just U.S. There's some Canadian and I think some U.K. that somehow get caught up in this. So they maintain this history. And so there's sort of a Hobbesian bargain going on, because the credit granters say, well, we want the ability to know the history of people we don't already know. And so these aggregators say, well, we'll tell you the history of people you ask us about in return for you telling us the delinquency, right, or failure to honor the credit, and their credit lines and everything else of the customers you already have. So there's this bidirectional flow of information. What ends up happening is that these three agencies aggregate over time a huge amount of very personal data and background. In fact, you know, in order to do their job, they're a database that has to store detailed information, private information about consumers. And notice that this is not anything that a consumer asks for. I never signed up with these companies, yet they've got complete records of my entire credit history without me doing anything, without me giving them permission. Well, this is all from
you. What? You don't give them permission, but whenever you acquire a loan or buy a car or rent an apartment or get a credit card, in all of that documentation, you give permission for them to report all of your activity to a credit reporting agency. So
right,
you don't give it to them specifically, but you've agreed to it.
It's in the fine print, essentially.
In the very, yes, very fine print, yeah.
Well, and the other thing I'm seeing, and I'm sure you are too, Leo, is from time to time you get letters from your bank or from, you know, investment firms or whatever who have saying, we're updating our privacy terms. And if you don't do anything, then you're implicitly giving us permission to share your information with others, you know, with our, you know, marketing partners or our financial partners. And so, unfortunately, a U.S. consumer has to be very proactive if they want to minimize the amount of information which is leaked about them and hungrily aggregated by these companies. And of course, what has then evolved is the so-called credit score, which reduces all of this through some sort of equation to a number. I don't know. Is it like 0 to 1,000 or 0 to 850,
something like that.
850?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe it's 900. So, I've never seen 900, but I guess it's theoretically possible.
And I did coincidentally, I was talking to someone the other day who was having a problem, and her score was like in the 400s because,
yeah,
you know, she was, yeah, considered not a very good risk.
Right.
Okay, so what happened? Equifax lost control of this database. Now, and again, we don't have complete disclosure yet. I'm sure Congress is going to be getting complete disclosure, because, I mean, this was – in some cases, I know that I saw a piece that Dan Gooden wrote for Ars Technica wondering whether this might not be the worst personal information disclosure so far in history. I mean, it's bad. 143 million U.S. customers, which is approximately 44% of the U.S. population, had highly personal data, including, of course, the names, but also their social security numbers, their dates of birth, their physical addresses, in some instances, their driver's license numbers. In a subset, about 209,000 also had their current credit card account numbers And there were also some sort of dispute documents where you go back and forth in order to say, wait a minute, you've got some bad information about me. And I've had that happen. I've never fought them. But, for example, they had like some bogus physical addresses for me in one of them. I don't remember who it was, but it was like, okay, I never lived in Montana ever. But they seem to think that was a previous address for me. So there is, unfortunately, you know, they're sucking all this stuff up, and there's no feedback unless you go and pull your report from these people and then argue with them about things that they got wrong, because otherwise it's just sort of being done passively. Oh, yes, and information also about UK and Canadian residents were also there. So what we know from still kind of fragmentary information, but I've now found that in multiple places, and in some cases, financial ratings stock market equity summaries that are very careful about being correct with their facts. We believe that Equifax first became aware of the incident on July 29th. So, 6 weeks ago. Okay, while the breach is believed to have occurred somewhere around mid-May, meaning that half of May, all of June, and all of July, 2.5 months before they were even aware. So that's raised throughout the industry a big red flag. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, this company that we're trusting with this kind of information could have somebody accessing their data. And apparently this didn't happen all at once. It was over time for 2.5 months undetected until they figured it out. But then, of course, once they did on July 29th, this only came to light last week, which means it ended 5 weeks after knowing that they had had a catastrophic breach in their security affecting 143 million U.S. consumers, putting our credit at risk. Because the idea is that with this information that they had that got loose, other people could impersonate us and apply for loans and credit under our name with, you know, and get credit cards and change addresses and so forth, and thus really cause havoc. So it's also a concern not only that they didn't know about this for 2.5 months, but that they waited for 5 weeks before letting us know. And there was also some reporting that tried to make a deal, make an issue of the fact that three Equifax executives cashed out $1.8 million of their stock during this interval. But there has been a formal statement from Equifax saying that none of those three executives had any idea. They were not in the loop. So this is not them trying to cash out before Equifax's stock crashed. And no one's expecting this is the end of Equifax. The one equity firm whose report I read said, well, maybe it'll take a 10% hit, but, you know, they'll recover over time. It's not the end of the world. Still, it's disturbing that this is the way they behaved. So, okay, what do we know about how this happened? That was sort of what happened. Well, what we know is that the Equifax system is based on a well-known open-source server-side Java-based web design framework called Apache Struts. It's a sophisticated system, that is, Apache Struts is, that needs to be used responsibly. You know, Java is a serious industrial strength language, but it's not a toy. You need to know how to use it correctly. So it doesn't do a lot of hand holding for you, requires competent developers. And as we'll see in a bit when we talk of the per user unlock authentication pins, the competence and attention to detail of Equifax developers easily calls, you know, calls their competence into question. So because Apache Struts and the Apache Struts project, which is part of the, you know, the Apache Foundation, has been called into question, Renee Galen, who is the VP of the Apache Struts Apache Project Management Committee, went on the record to address the fact that, you know, they seem to have been implicated. Their code appears to be to have been implicated in this. And there's some interesting information here. So he said the Apache Struts Project Management Committee would like to comment on the Equifax security breach, its relation to the Apache Struts web framework, and associated media coverage. We are sorry, of course, to hear news that Equifax suffered from a security breach and an information disclosure incident that was potentially carried out by exploiting a vulnerability in the Apache Struts web framework. At this point in time, it is not, and I edited this a little bit, at this point in time, it is not clear which Struts vulnerability would have been utilized, if any. In an online article posted on Quartz.com, the assumption was made that the breach could be related to, and there's a CVE number, we'll call it the 9805, it's 2017, so it's this year, 9805, which was publicly announced 8 days ago on September 4th, along with new Struts framework software releases to patch this and other vulnerabilities. So, you know, Apache Struts is being, you know, immediately responsive and responsible. However, they write, the security breach was detected by Equifax in July, which means that the attackers either an earlier announced vulnerability on an unpatched Equifax server. Okay, so that would say that there may have been something else that was previously known and patched in the open source community, which Equifax may not have bothered to keep current. That's a theory. We don't know that yet. Or they exploited a vulnerability which was not known at the time. Thus, they may have independently discovered this 9805 known problem that was disclosed last week, or something else. Again, we don't know. No doubt there's forensics people looking at this now to get a better sense for what was going on. Frankly, given what we will talk about in a second about the construction of the PIN, the secret passcode that users are given when they lock down access to their credit reports, that really doesn't inspire much confidence. Not to mention the fact that they're explaining about how to use Netscape Navigator on their site. So, if the breach was caused, they write, by exploiting this 9805 known as of last week, it would have been a zero-day exploit at that time. And the Quartz.com article also states, and these guys didn't respond to that, probably because they're embarrassed, that this 9805 vulnerability has existed for 9 years. So it's been there like forever in internet time. And if it were independently found, that would be a problem. But again, as we know, mistakes happen. And Apache Struts immediately fixed it and issued an update. We don't know what Equifax was using on their servers and whether they were being as responsible or not. Okay, so this goes on for a while, but it ends with properly phrased good security advice, just to sort of, you know, wrap things up, which was, you know, keep your frameworks and libraries up to date. Make sure that you're staying current. That is that, you know, you're using the latest that is available. A note that complex software always contains flaws. And so, you know, don't depend, says Apache Struts guys, don't build your security policy around the assumption that the supporting software products are flawless, but rather use a defense in depth approach, a multi-layered approach, and importantly, monitor. As we've said often, it is ultimately monitoring to see if what's going on your network makes sense. If you can explain all of the traffic that you're seeing, that's crucial. No matter what your defenses have, you also have to watch. So that's the techie open source web framework side of this. So finally, the consequence in the public is, not surprisingly, that in the wake of this news, everyone has been rushing to lock down their reporting. As I said, the danger to consumers is that a huge database, 44% of U.S. consumers have enough information now loose, including their Social Security number, in some cases credit card numbers, their date of birth, their physical address. I mean, you know, everything you need typically you provide to a credit grantor to grant you credit is now available. So our listeners who followed our advice many years ago, 2.5 years ago, may already have been protected. On Security Now, episode 495, which you and I, Leo, recorded on February 17th, 2015, that podcast was titled HTTP/2. And I said, and Elaine transcribed, I said, okay, lastly, and this is, hyphen, I probably should have done this first, but these other stories were just too interesting, and the industry's been buzzing about them. I created a bit.ly link for this, and it's important. bit.ly/freezecredit, all lowercase. This takes you to a page where the guy explains that a service that is available to anyone for all three major credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, allows consumers who are not the victims of identity theft to lock their credit reports. It's not free, but it's not too expensive.
This cost varies. Clark Howard's page. It's a good page. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. The cost varies depending on where you are, from $3 to $10. In California, it was $10. And because I was curious to do this, although I wasn't worried about this recent Anthem breach, and that's what brought this current, it was the Anthem breach 2.5 years ago, I said, I locked my credit reports. It was $10 for each. And you, Leo, responded, you may have to pay to thaw it as well, and that's important. So we talked about this 2.5 years ago. I, my friends, and family locked ourselves down. So what that meant was that it is impossible, given that the lock is honored, possible for anyone to apply to use these three firms' reports in order to get credit granted. And so, for example, if I needed a loan for something, I would have to explicitly unlock access in order to permit it. And of course, there's been a lot of controversy about this naturally in the last week, because this has put a big spotlight on the whole locking unlocking process. And many consumers are annoyed that they're being charged to do something that they never asked for in the first place. But in truth, and as you said, Leo, in order to be granted credit, you need to prove your credit worthiness. So this is indirectly a service for consumers, although we certainly need the people who maintain all this data to be responsible with it. So weak pins. Someone tweeted to me at SGGRC, how much entropy is there in a timestamp? Would be great to hear the breakdown in tomorrow's show. The answer to the question, how much entropy is there in a timestamp? None. Zero. It is entirely deterministic and predictable. There's about a timestamp. It increments uniformly. I mean, it's like none. Okay. So Equifax said in response to people noticing that the PIN was a timestamp, they responded, while we have confidence in the current system. Okay, stop right there. What? They said, we understand and appreciate that consumers have questions about how PINs are how PINs are currently generated. We are engaged in a process that will provide consumers a randomly generated PIN.
Oh.
What an innovation, Leo.
No.
Imagine that. We expect this change to be effective within 24 hours. A consumer has an option and will continue to have an option.
Idiots.
Oh, Leo, get this. The PIN is MMDDYYHHMM. Month, day, year, hour, and when I saw that,
possibly
I went
be
back
a collision.
Well, could you guess it? No, you couldn't possibly guess
it. Never in a million years.
I went back and looked, and I'm a little annoyed with myself for not actually looking at the PIN.
Yeah.
Yes, but I know the day, date, and hour and minute that I applied, because it's right there in my record of my quote. You know, my Lord,
so terrible.
Yeah. So this is what I was saying. If a company is issuing you a secret token, which is a time and date stamp of when you submitted your request online, it's no security. And it is obviously brute forceable. It's incredible. So, you know, in the best case, it's very low entropy, and I can't explain this. I mean, we already know. You could take a counter and hash it and give somebody 8 digits or 12 digits or whatever you wanted of that as a PIN. Or if you wanted to be able to relate it, take the timestamp with a nonce, because you want to have a nonce, and symmetrically encrypt it with a secret key. That would give the consumer something unpredictable and completely random. But if you then, but if they give it back to you, you could decrypt it back into that original timestamp if for some reason you needed a timestamp. I mean, it's just like it's so obvious how to do this right. And these people just thought, why bother? So again, it's difficult to give them latitude. And of course, finally, we have the expected class action lawsuit arising from this. A couple of plaintiffs who were tweaked by this found themselves a class action firm. I'm sure they were lining up to go after Equifax. And so there's a class action in works seeking as much as $70 billion in damages for all of the consumers that were affected by this. So the bad news is that in the wake of this disclosure of this disclosure, consumers did, I mean, like my best buddy Mark has like been frantic on the phone with me. What do I do? What do I do? I said, I'll have a full readout by the end of the podcast. I'll be up to speed and I'll have dug into this. Everybody has been running to lock their reports down, as we discussed 2.5 years ago. And for what it's worth, again, that bit.ly link, bit.ly/freeze credit, is still valid. You just brought the page up, Leo, and it's a good page to talk people through how to do that. The problem is that the three bureaus have been crashing because of the demand on their sites for everyone who wants to pay $10 or whatever it is, 10 in California, to each of the three agencies.
Some states it's free. In Maine, it's free. So don't assume it's going to cost you anything. It's just, you know,
each
state has its own rules on that.
Yeah, and in fact, in our reporting 2.5 years ago, I said between $3 and $10. So, yeah. But again, $0 and $10, probably as a function of what the state allows these guys to charge. Maine probably just said, no, exactly. You're not charging anybody anything for that. Because they would certainly like to if they could.
Oh, yeah.
So the final takeaway is, depending upon how concerned you are, remember that there is an inconvenience associated with this. I've been locked for 2.5 years because I haven't needed to apply for credit in 2.5 years. I like my credit cards. They're fine. And so I'm in a stage of my life where I'm not buying things that I need loans for any longer. So they've been that lock I applied at. I mean, I know exactly when because my PIN tells me. Back when I was researching this for that after the Anthem breach, but it is an inconvenience if you need to be unlocking it all the time, especially if they're going to ding you again for the privilege of releasing the lock on your account, and then you're going to want to go back and re-stealth yourself by locking it again. The system's a little broken, but unfortunately, it's an asset of some value because it does allow people whose credit has been established to have the freedom of having a third party to represent that, yes, you've been making your payments on time. But with it comes a responsibility that Equifax, at worst, they made a mistake. I think maybe as more facts come out and this unfolds, we'll get a better sense for just, you know, how irresponsible they were. We don't really have a calibration on that yet.
Amazing.
Yeah.
There is, you know, we talked, didn't we, about that chat bot that you could use to fight traffic tickets in the UK, and they launched it in the US. Apparently he's added a feature now that you can sue Equifax using I think it's for like $35,000 using the chat bot. So I think Equifax is going to get some heat, quite a bit of heat from this Congress.
Yeah, there's something that I missed also, Leo. I don't know if you picked up on this, but there was something about something that you did which caused you in the fine print to lose the ability to sue them.
That's actually not the case. It might be the case.
And that's why I didn't cover it. I was never quite clear on what
so
it was.
So if you went, and no one should ever do this, because you no reason to deal with Equifax any further. But if you decided to go to their goofball site where you would figure out if you had been hacked, Brian Krebs went there and entered random name and numbers and got the same response as if he didn't. So it's a goofball site. And apparently its real purpose is to move you through to their free credit monitoring, Trusted ID. If you agree to that, there is a arbitration clause in that. But both, first of all, I don't know how binding it would be. Secondly, Equifax has said, well, this only applies to our Trusted ID service. It does not apply to the breach. We're not going to assert that you can't sue us. Although they've been fighting hard. They've been giving lots of money to members of Congress to eliminate the ability for consumers to sue and eliminate the CFPB, the credit Consumer Credit Protection Bureau. So, I mean, these guys are as bad as they can get. They're just as bad. They collect. I mean, we talk about Google and Facebook invading privacy. These guys do it. They collect all your data. They don't secure it. And then have the gall to try to make money off of this breach by signing up for free protection, which will, of course, on year one plus a day, start charging you. It's kind of the gall of these guys is mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. I would like to know what they do in the other countries for this kind of credit reporting. They must have some system. Maybe it's run by the government. I don't know, but there has to be a way to verify your credit worthiness.
I'm not the free enterprise.
Well, that's the thing. We live in a capitalist society, and this is not only legal; it's kind of encouraged and supported by the government. Well, Steve, what a good job you've done of synopsizing this. And you warned us all a long time ago, freeze your credit. It's kind of a pain if you're in the, if you're young and you're doing a lot of credit.
Yep.
You know, buying stuff, getting credit cards, getting set up in life. It may not be worth the cost and the hassle of freezing and unfreezing. But us old farts should definitely do it. Besides, you know, we've got more to lose. We've got assets. What's your opinion on credit monitoring? Have you ever kind of thought about that or delved into that?
Yeah, and that was another question that my buddy Mark asked. He said, what about LifeLock? And I said, well, when the FTC stops suing them for overstating their benefits to the consumer, you know, maybe. I don't know.
There's a story with LifeLock. I'm not convinced that that's LifeLock, by the way. I should mention that I think they have been in the past a sponsor of some of the shows, maybe the radio show. But I use them and pay for them. The reason LifeLock got sued, and it didn't get sued by the feds, but it got sued by many states, I think the FTC might have ended up going after them, is that Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax went after them because what LifeLock originally did was put credit freezes on your account for you and maintain them.
Nice.
And that means that those companies can't, Equifax, TransUnion, and
can't sell
Experian
your data.
Can't make money off of you.
Right.
So they went after these guys, and what they did is, and we've seen this method, this methodology used before. They went to individual states' attorneys general, and said, you know, it would be nice. Here's a little campaign contribution if you were to go after these guys. So it's kind of too bad because LifeLock ended up having to stop doing the credit freezes. They succeeded. But what they did was, I thought, quite smart. They bought one of the big back-end companies that does the transactions for most credit card companies. And this is the company that does the fraud alerts for your credit card company. So they do have access to a huge data flow. But even then, the attorneys general and the FTC said, well, you can't say you can watch all transactions. Well, obviously, cash transactions don't go through these services. There's stuff that happens you can't see. The bigger question is if credit monitoring does you any good. I mean, I have a LifeLock and I get periodically, we just saw your driver's license on the dark web. Well, what am I supposed to do about that now? Nothing. There's nothing I can do. How do you act?
Yeah, we've all heard these horror stories about identity theft. I mean, how it's almost impossible. Like, it just ruins your life to have your identity stolen.
That's what these companies offer, by the way, and mostly. That's certainly what LifeLock offers is insurance. And help in restoring your identity. Maybe that's what you're really paying for. I don't know. I pay for it, and I'd get it for my kids. When this happened, I got it for Lisa and Michael, only because why take a chance, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's a lot cheaper to buy that than it is to fight identity theft.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think the jury's out on whether LifeLock really did anything wrong or if this was just the big three trying to put them out of business. By the way, there's a fourth called Anovis that is not on this Clark Howard page, but you can go to Anovis and freeze your credit there too. Interesting, huh? What a world we live in. Steve's show is available in a fine, high-quality 64 kilobit MP3. On his website, grc.com, as are those fine transcriptions Elaine Ferris writes for us. You'll also find SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility there, and many, many, many free things, grc.com, including Shields Up, Squirrel, his supplement history, all that supplement info.
The healthy sleep formula.
Healthy sleep formula. All you got to do is go to grc.com, Gibson Research Corporation. And as for us, we have it at twit.tv/SN, Security Now. And we also have video, should you wish to see the growth of Steve's mustache over the years.
As it returns to the world.
As it returns to the world. You can also subscribe in whatever podcatcher you use. You'll find Security Now. Any show that's been around 13 years is probably in every directory. Please do subscribe. That way you'll get every episode. I won't be here next Tuesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC, but Father Robert Ballester will, and Steve Gibson certainly will. He never gets sick. He never misses a day. He's just the Iron Man of security podcasts. Next Tuesday, we'll see you. Thank you, Steve. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, Lee, and we'll see you in 3 weeks.
See you later.
All tanned or whatever you are after that.
I don't think it's going to be one of those tanning. I might be a little fatter.
I might have my liver force-fed, but other than that, yeah.
Okay, my friend.
Security.